This episode of Where to Begin With will feature heavy spoilers of the movie Primer from 2004. If you've never seen the movie before and you want to take part in this series by submitting an e-review, then hit stop right now. Go away, check the movie out. It's only 77 minutes long, and send your review into the show. If you have seen the movie before, or you just don't care about spoilers, then keep listening on. Don't say you weren't warned.
You're talking about making a bigger one. You're talking about making a bigger one.
Welcome back to Where to Begin With. This is season number 4, episode number 2. I'm your host Duncan McLeish, and yeah, let's just get into it, shall we? The movie I have selected for this second time travel quote-unquote horror series is the movie Primer. Now, I know what you're saying. I have now watched this movie, Duncan, and I can attest, ain't a horror movie. And you're right, it isn't, actually. It's some dark undertones for sure, a level of ominousness, ominosity, there's ominous undertones throughout, but yeah, it's certainly not a horror movie. Why did I pick it? Well, I'll be honest, this is a selfish way of me very cleverly sliding titles in that I think are worthy of note, that I'll be honest, I don't know of any other show that I've ever been invited on, or any other thing I've ever done where Primer would be a movie I could select to talk about. So this is a cheat. This is your cheat meal podcast of the year. I can't guarantee as we work through the remainder of the science fiction that we're going to be doing on Where to Begin with Season 4 that I don't sneak another oddball in here. But this one, I felt if we did it early, then we get it out the way. Everyone feels better about themselves. And when I say everyone, I mean me. And hopefully you guys, if you've never seen Primer before, you are ticking off a magical black spot in your knowledge of cinema. Now, notwithstanding the fact that Shane Carruth is, to see a polarising figure is beyond the realms of what is acceptable in society now, he's a guy that has pretty much shown himself to be a woman abuser. And I mean, we haven't heard any fallout since, what, 2001, where he was arrested for, or at least charges were pressed on him for domestic abuse. But, you know, his former marriage broke down. And was revealed later on that he'd been involved with some domestic abuse there, both verbally and physically, emotionally as well. So it's kind of the tragic end of what, for all intents and purposes, was one of the most exciting filmmakers of the 2000s. You could argue, I would say it's a great argument, that without the forethought of Shane Carruth and Primer, you might not have a Benson and Moorhead combination hitting you with such movies as Resolution and The Endless, and Something in the Dark, and everything that those guys do, it probably wouldn't exist. We, on the old podcast Under the Stairs Movie Club, we did a movie called Coherence. I would argue that there wouldn't be a movie like Coherence in a world where Primer doesn't exist. I would go one step further forward. I would say that without Primer, I don't think you get movies along the lines and levels of Triangle and Time Crimes. You know, its effect on horror is prevalent, which is kind of why I'm sneaking it in here. Furthermore, I think if you look at the last, 10 years of cinema, arguably one of the most successful, like, blockbuster movies that kind of dealt with time travel in a kind of more dystopian and science fiction surrounding would be Looper, directed by Rian Johnson. Rian Johnson actually had Shane Carruth in as a consultant producer on the movie Looper, specifically bouncing off the ideas and concepts of time travel and its use in the film. So this guy, you know, is the guy. He has only ever made two movies, though. He's done a ton of acting. In fact, most recently was in the Amazon TV show, was it In the Loop or The Loop or whatever it was, and I remember seeing him in there. He did The Dead Center from a few years ago, where he was the main actor in that as well. So yeah, he's been around. He's done his stuff, but ultimately he had a couple of scripts for movies that were never made as well, that like appeared to get the internet all aflutter. And I don't want to spend a huge inordinate amount of time chatting about Shane Carruth, because like I said before, he is a guy who has ultimately pretty much destroyed his career. I don't think he's going to come back with anything out with the occasional obscure indie, you know, acting role. I don't think we'll ever see another directed movie from him. He's pretty much brought to the end of his filmmaking career, pretty much at his own hands. But it's difficult to discuss Primer without discussing Shane Carruth, because on the piddly sum, the measly the penance of money, I think they reckoned about $8,000 he wrote, filmed, edited and created Primer. And Primer is a movie that, like, destroyed critics when they saw it at the I think it was Sundance Film Festival, where it was awarded the Grand Jury Prize, and is a movie that will be constantly reevaluated as time goes on. I think it's, if you want to discuss about the pitfalls and trappings of time travel in movies, Primer might be the apex example of how you do it right, and might be the only movie that's ever actually done it right. Now, I'm sure, knowing my audience, there are temporal scientists out there that understand time travel and all the concepts there within. I'm sure you're out there. I'm sure you understand it better than I. What I'm going to say to you is, in cinema, I have tried to poke holes in the way time works and its loops there within for Primer, and I can't do it. He seems to have very smartly, very cleverly, and very articulately brought together an almost flawless design in the movie Primer. Now, add to that this movie is an hour and 17 minutes long. That's including credits, ladies and gents. That's what blows my mind. This is not a movie that gets stuck in jargon, but rather, which is where all the movies fall apart, by the way, but it's rather a movie that leans into the ideas of, let's just give you a relatively simple concept, let's give you a group of rules that must be followed, let's have minimal set design, and two characters who appear to be best friends, but actually, when push comes to shove, have completely their own ideas about what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable once discovering the concept of time travel. When you bring all that in together, it is a compelling story, first and foremost, and it just so happens that the math in the background holds up too. Now, for those that get stuck in this movie, that's fine. I've watched Primer about easily about 10 times. Most of that is because of its short runtime, but that's over many, many years. I saw this movie not long after it came out on DVD in the UK, because I was like obsessed, like absolutely obsessed, and also working in a video store at the time. So I had my chance to get my hands on this one pretty much from the off. And yeah, it had a bit of a reputation about it, and has grown at like a mini cult following. I'm also a guy that loves his horror, but loves science fiction. Science fiction was probably what I got into before I got into horror. So yeah, like seeing it done well on the screen is quite compelling. It is a minimalist plot, a minimalist cast. The main roles of Aaron, played by Shane Carruth, and Abe, played by David Sullivan, are the two guys that inadvertently create a box that allows them to time travel. And once they find out how they can do it, basically by switching on a machine which will lock the point and then getting into the machine later in the day, looping them back, they then decide that ahead of them becoming very, very wealthy on this, they're almost going to back to the future by playing the stock market. And then they set out just a simple group of rules that both of them must follow in order to maximise the power of this, whilst also marketing it and being able to create wealth from it. The problem is that Aaron and Abe don't necessarily trust each other all that well with everything that's going through their mind, and as a result their plans start to deviate pretty quick. And then once they start to deviate, you end up in a scenario where there are multiple timelines. At any given point, I think there's up to, by the end of this, at least 5 Aaron characters and at least 3 Abe characters. I might be wrong, there might be 4, but and it continually twists and turns and loops and kind of resets. And the more it does that, the more compelling the story is. It has some dynamics, yeah, and some other characters in the background and conversations that you should certainly take stock of, but at the same time, those are not the important aspects of the story. The important aspects are where the boxes are, what time they're set at, who or what version of Abe and Aaron actually enter them, and what the purpose of entering them is. When do they end up when they go in them, at what time in the movie? Once you've kind of got your head around that, I would say maybe 2 or 3 watches. It's fascinating to see how well this holds together. Actually, it's jaw-dropping to see how well this holds together. It's not a beautifully shot movie. It's shot cheaply. Remember what I said? About $8,000 to make this movie. And Shane Carruth is a good actor, and David Sullivan is a good actor. The supporting cast here, not really, and pretty forgettable as it goes on. But its strength isn't necessarily in its performance and its script, but rather how easy it is to kind of, on some level, sympathise, but also understand the motivations behind these characters. They're not born of some sort of Machiavellian greed to take over the world. If anything, it's relatively small potatoes when you think about what you might do if you harness the power of time travel. I think Primer is a wonderful example of not overstaying its welcome. It understands that by about the hour part, audiences are going to start to feel like their head is maybe starting to be squeezed just a little bit, and as a result, they kind of want to bow out, and the movie allows you to do that comfortably with its relatively concise short runtime. It's a movie also that never feels like it should talk down to you. I kind of love that about that. There's that great line in Looper where Joseph Gordon-Levitt's with his older self, spoilers for anyone that hasn't seen that movie, Bruce Willis, are sitting at a table, and like Gordon-Levitt just has questions about how time works and time travel works. And Bruce Willis, as the proxy for not only Rian Johnson, but like the audience, is we're not gonna explain time travel. I'm not gonna do it. Like I don't want to talk about it. It's kind of telling the audience, right? Like, listen, if we explain this, it's not gonna make sense. But just enjoy the ride. Primer never does that, and that's kind of to its credit. it exists in a world where everything it actually does feels believable, even though it's dealing with a concept which is maybe the most science fiction of all science fiction, next to intergalactic space travel. Time travel's right beside that. It's a movie that holds up, I would argue, just as important now, and a movie that would play exceptionally well with some of the movies that we've already mentioned. I think you could shove Primer on as a Primer resolution, The Endless, triple bill. I would definitely say you could play this alongside either Time Crimes or Triangle, and I think it really, really, really works. It's an incredible piece of cinema. I think it's one of the more important movies of the last 20 years, and I don't say that lightly. I think it's fucking excellent, and hopefully you enjoyed it as well. I'm super curious. I know I'm pushing you off from the horror train into something which is maybe less horror, definitely less horror, but maybe more science fiction and more in a realm of a movie that you might never have seen before. Albeit Primer did win awards and does get a lot of accolades, still criminally underseen. So I'm interested, from your perspective as reviewers, how many people had actually seen Primer before? And after watching it, what did you make of it? And if you get the time, did you watch it more than once? It's a short runtime, so you can do it. Two viewings of this movie is still shorter than your average Marvel movie. So just keep that in the back of your head when you're sitting down to watch it. So that's my review of Primer. Hugely important, hugely influential. Yes, it's my cheat review of this season, but I stand by it. I think it's excellent. And like I see, the building blocks for the movies I've mentioned, which were more obvious choices and may still pop up before the season's over, are found here. So if we're doing Where to Begin with Time Travel and Horror, I think if you're doing Where to Begin with Time Travel and Horror in the 2000s and beyond, Primer might actually be the most important movie of them all. It's the Rosetta Stone for what comes after, for sure. Now, I'm going to let you know how you can interact with this show and how you can submit your reviews through to me to feature on the next episode. But we have some B-snatch to get to, ladies and gents. That's what the cool kids call business, so I've been told. And that will involve us jumping to the old reviews of our previous movie, Triangle. And we have three reviews in. I love it when we have more than two. First one is a written review, and it comes in from our great buddy Catherine, who says, Triangle is a hugely unique film in that its protagonist is generally unlikable and does not succeed in her quest. Rather, the quest is enacted upon by her fate, forcing her to bend to cycles beyond her control. The film is about internally warring parts of itself, with a psychological or philosophical, approach rooted in some kind of existentialism and mysticism. Jess, a single mother who works in a diner, is invited on an afternoon of sailing on the vessel Triangle by one of her patrons. When she arrives, she seems quite out of sorts and the other guests are put off by her. She looks more ragged and torn than they do, and is treated best by Heather, the one person who was not supposed to be invited. From the start, Jess is portrayed as the good mother of a disabled son, although there are red flags from the moment of her entry on the dock, that this might not actually be the case. She doesn't seem to really know where her son is, just tossing out that he's at school. The group have a casual time on board the beautiful sailboat. It's clear that the host Greg's best friend Sally does not want Jess hanging around with him. She fundamentally finds her disturbing. They banter away sailing in the beautiful sun until they hit a perfectly dead spot in the water. Apologies for misreading that. The wind just dies. A violent storm hits, capsizing the boat, but leaving the group intact and unscathed, except for Heather, the one person who was not invited. Perching on the underside of the boat, they see a vast cruise ship approaching, looking like a dingy, malevolent ghost ship. It is the Aeolus. Wrapped in the idea of rescue, they call it and see a figure on the deck without being able to see their face. and Jess pauses, clearly shimmering in a moment of the uncanny, already haunted. They board the ship, and Jess is sure she's been there before. It's explained that Elias is the Greek god of the winds and father of Sisyphus, who cheated death by making him a promise that he didn't keep. This led to his punishment by being forced eternally in the underworld to push an enormous boulder to the top of a mountain, only to see it roll down the slope again and then repeat its cycle. I've always interpreted this myth as a metaphor for the futility of the efforts of mankind against the forces of the universe, and that seems to be how it plays out in this story. In the hallway, the only other sign of life is a set of keys found by Victor, which Jess immediately recognises as her own. The rest of the group don't believe her and respond with irritation and almost revulsion, seeing her as crazy. They keep seeing another person on board out of the corner of their eye, but can't quite identify who it is. Jess tells Greg that she's having deja vu around every corner, and he posits, "Is it Tommy? Is it guilt? Do you feel guilty?" They enter room 237, any reference to The Shining, which has wallpaper in a pattern evocative of the carpet in that film. They enter a steaming bedroom where they see "Go to the Theatre" written in blood above the mirror, a la Red Rum. Jess is starting to freak out and Greg tries to calm her down, telling her, "Don't you see this is all in your head? Ships don't just appear, they have skippers. Well, maybe they do in your world." She pushes back with a sentence that becomes a refrain throughout the rest of the film. Casting herself as the good mother, she says, "My world is waiting outside for his mother to pick him up from school. Don't talk to me about my world." The other couple, Sally and Downey, start to see drops of blood on the deck and go out the theatre. Jess is in the restaurant and Victor enters, beat and bloodied. As he approaches her, he grips her neck to choke her. She stops him by sticking a finger into a hole she's seen punctured into his head, and then she hears a gunshot and Greg is down. Sally and Downey are screaming and her shouts about shooting him, but she doesn't understand because she was with Victor, and then a figure with a bag on their head starts shooting from the balcony, hitting Downey. Jess retreats and has a confrontation with the baghead on deck. Baghead has a shotgun trained on her, but hesitates to pull the trigger. Jess wrestles the gun to right and left. Bag takes some shots, runs out of ammo and throws a gun at her, and Jess grabs an axe and they battle again with an axe and a wrench. Before getting pushed overboard, Baghead says to Jess, "You have to kill them. It's the only way to go home. Kill them," and then falls into the sea. She hears old-timey music and then there's an old record skipping in the ship. She resets it, looks in the mirror, and then hears the group calling out from the triangle. It's at this point she looks over the side of the ship and realises that she's in some kind of time loop. She bumps the record player and it starts skipping again. Then she hears herself from the other part of the ship saying, "I feel like I know this place." It's at this point she drops her keys. After returning to room 237, she goes out on the deck to see gulls eating Downey's corpse. Victor finds her, the second her, and as he's looking around for signs of life, this is when her internal voice ramps up the question who she is and where all her actions fall into the spectrum of cause and effect. She's desperately trying to explain the situation to Victor. She pushes him up against the wall, accidentally puncturing the soft part between his neck and skull, creating the wound she originally encountered when fighting him off from choking her. Her immediate reaction is disbelief and displacement of responsibility. She says, "I didn't do this. I didn't do this." Despondent, she finds herself sitting on the floor of the locker room thinking to herself, "Who are you?" Where she finds a bunch of crunched up notes that read, "If they board, kill them all." To test her, she writes it again on a pad of paper, comparing the writing, and it's exactly the same, confirming that indeed she has written every single one of the piles of notes on the floor. She finds the boiler suit, bag, mask and shotgun in a closet, echoing internally, "If they board, kill them." Her inner monologue driving her to the frustration she shouts, "Fuck you," into the mirror. She sees her necklace with the locket holding the photos of her and her son hanging in the grill, but she's still wearing the necklace, which confuses her. Then looking down, she sees a pile of necklaces and the latest one now falls to join them. This is where the use of piles of things becomes an ongoing tool for demonstrating the repetition of events. From here, we see the series of repetitions with iterations of Jess, Greg, Downey, Sally, and Victor. She begins to have delusions that she can't control the cycle, break the cycle, if she can only prevent the stranded group from boarding the Helios. As she navigates a labyrinth, her dialogue is punctured with denial and justifications like, "You're not me," to her alternative self. "You see, I'm not crazy. We can change the pattern, and that wasn't me." The most dramatic use of the piling up of objects is demonstrated repetition occurs when she drags a stabbed Sally up to corner of the deck where there are heaps of other dead Sallys being picked by seagulls. In this scene, Jess, trying to save Sally, attempts to convince her that everything can be okay again. She insists that it wasn't she who stabbed her, when it clearly in fact was. No, it was that particular version of her. But her desperation to convince Sally that everything can be okay is just as futile as her denial of being the cause of violence. This is paired with another great visual of Jess looking down, watching herself fight the bad kid who gets pushed overboard again. The visual of Sally dying upon the pile of other dead Sallys is beautifully grotesque, emphasising the fear and confusion she feels as consciousness slips away. Immediately as she dies, the group on the triangle show up again. This is when Jess realises that the loop will only reset once everyone in the group has been killed. This realisation is what drives her to become Baghead, on a mission of mercy to kill them all and escape the loop. We only get to follow this iteration of Jess in the first person with her until she is pushed overboard and washed away to sea. This takes us to a part of the loop that's off the ship, letting the audience know that her torment extends beyond the ship. After waking up on the beach, boiler suit swing gently in the surf, she gets herself back home again. Here, she witnesses herself interacting with her son the morning before the sailing trip. In fact, she is not the good mother she professed to be. She's short-tempered, abusive, raging in frustration to the universe just to have one fucking day off. The torrent of abuse towards her autistic son culminates as she spills paint. She actually slaps him across the face and rants, "You know, you get this from your father. He was an asshole too." Tommy spilled the paint after seeing the other Jess in the window. This Jess looking in can't tolerate the abusive version of herself that she sees. This is really the crux of the matter and the subject of the film. Both Jessies are real, both are true. There is a split there that cannot be reconciled internally. And every effort Jess makes to eliminate her intolerable identity leads her back into the same loop of her own horrific story. Finally, she distracts the abusive self and then kills her with a hammer, which is witnessed by Tommy. She holds him close and tries to convince him that it's all just a bad dream. She packs her dead self into a duffel bag, puts it in the trunk of the car, and packs Tommy in to the driveway from the house. We see the sign, "Goodbye, please return the Sunshine State," which is a nice touch. Again, she believes she can control the loop and make everything okay. She tells Tommy that everything will be different, Mummy won't lose her temper anymore, and she won't hurt you. Just at that moment, we see blood on the windshield, and Tommy is upset by it. She pulls over and tries to calm him, but she'll bury the gull. However, as she picks it up with a piece of paper and drops it all over the seawall, what does she see but a pile of dead gulls? She gets back in the car and quickly tries to usher them out of there, but Tommy is still upset, yelling, "Blood, blood," and pointing to the windshield. She starts to get irritated again and screams, "Stop screaming." Attempting to control the situation, she uses the window wipers to push the blood away and turn around to see Tommy saying, "See, it's gone, see." At which point she veers into head-on traffic and collides with a truck. As far as the onlookers are concerned, they only see her, the dead her from the trunk, and her son who has died. But this Jess, who has returned from the Helios, drifts away from the wreck and into the path of a mysterious cab driver. He informs her there's no point in trying to save the boy, there's nothing anyone can do to bring him back, at which point he offers her a ride. He takes her to the harbour, back to the triangle, but insists he leaves the meter running and makes her a promise that she'll come back. So does promise, as Sisyphus did, to return. and the whole sequence starts over again. At first, I was confused by the time loop, thinking that it might be a physics-based parallel universe. This couldn't possibly be, though, if there are multiple existing simultaneously, which in this story there clearly is. Rather, it's a metaphysical, or sorry, it's a mystical version, apologies, of an existential problem where we can never escape ourselves. A transposition of the myth of Sisyphus to a tormented parent who simply cannot come to grips with her fate. She's forced to repeat the cycle of violence, exhaustion, and shame until she's ready to pay the piper, so to speak. Until she can face her guilt without displacement of responsibility, she must reenact the same scenes infinitely. She fights against fate, forcing her will for everything to be okay onto reality, when in fact, this isn't reality at all. Even when the opportunity for acceptance and resolution is presented to her, she instead chooses to try and kill the bad self to go back to the harbour and trigger all off all over again. This is a strong film, very well constructed and truly remarkable in its full inversion of the heroine trope. Tough to process, but ultimately rewarding. Thank you very much, Catherine. I love your reviews. I really do, and I'm looking forward to hearing your review of Primer. It's gonna be a talking point, and no doubt I get a feeling that we're gonna be talking about it one way or another. Right, let's jump to our next one. This is from our good buddy Tim Walker, who says, "Dear Duncan and Teapots Collective people, interesting choice to go sci-fi horror for the next season. I tend to be a fan of most sci-fi, but for crying out loud, don't put Jason in space. That's just fucking stupid. Anyway, more specifically, time travel horror is up first, and I find that subgenre intriguing, and Triangle is one I've seen before. I actually first watched it when it was fairly new in either 2009 or 2010. I remember watching it because it's instantly on Netflix, which at the time you could only do for selected movies. Yet Netflix was mostly by mail at that time. I loved it on its first watch. It had a very compelling and complex story. Like most time travel flicks, it can hurt your head if you think about it too much. The acting was top notch and it was very suspenseful and atmospheric. Plus, I love the look of the killer. It's that sack head like the killers in The Town That Dreaded Sundown or Friday the 13th Part 2. Over the years, I watched it a couple of more times and it has remained quite high in my estimation. This watch, I liked it even more, at least a little bit. I do recommend for those that either don't like or don't get it, which are not the same thing of course, looking around YouTube for reviews and interpretations of Triangle. Some of them help explain the movie pretty well and bring up interesting ideas, like the loop being not necessarily permanent because of the slight changes each time. I do recall the YouTuber Rob Eager, aka Collective Learning, mentioning that he really liked Triangle and reached out to Christopher Smith to compliment him. Agner had some fascinating videos with his take on some classic genre films, including a ton of horror like The Shining, Hereditary, and A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Terminator, and even Hellraiser. As far as I know, he hasn't done a whole video for Triangle, but if he likes a movie, it's got a bit more going on under the surface. He goes very in-depth in his analysis. Anyway, I don't have too many issues with Triangle. I think maybe my only complaint is that it may be a little bit too similar to a classic Twilight Zone episode called Judgment Night. Not a deal breaker by any stretch though. I'm going to give Triangle 4.5 stars out of 5, and it could even go up to a 5 on the next watch. Yeah, I love this one and can heartily recommend it. Thanks for picking it, Duncan. I was glad to give it a rewatch. Curious as to where we go next and what else everyone makes of it. Until then, I say take care, stay safe, and always write notes to yourself in the mirror. Tim. Thank you very much, Tim. Interesting that I'm curious about Primer for you, because Primer is definitely not horror, so we're off to the side, but the building blocks are there for a lot of what we get afterwards. So I'm super curious. I am honestly, I'm a little bit nervous, but also super curious to see where you guys land with it. If everyone comes back and says they fucking hate Primer, you know, I won't lose sleep over it, but I'm kind of hoping I can at least wrangle one newbie in, and you love it as much as I. That's the dream, and we can only dare to dream. Our final review comes in from our good buddy David Garrett Jr. It's an audio review, and David says,
"Hello, Duncan and T Puts Collective listeners. David Garrett Jr. here once again for Where to Begin With. And this is going to be a little interesting one, is that I kind of like what you're doing here in breaking this up, as the first three movies look like they're going to be time travel horror, with the first one being here of Triangle. Now, I believe I watched the correct one, as the year, I don't know if it was necessarily matching up, and it might have been me just misreading some things, but this is a movie that I saw the case when I was working at Family Video, but I cannot confirm that, actually. I know I'd seen it somewhere, so I'm just assuming it was when I was working at that video store. And it's one that I heard about through podcasts, though, and it intrigued me to learn more about it and how the title factors in. Interestingly, I originally thought this was going to take place around Miami, Florida, which would incorporate the Bermuda Triangle. Instead, they moved this to Australia, and I think part of that were the actors involved. Now, I did read an explanation of why they kept the name, even though this moved, and it actually makes a whole lot of sense still as well. So I want to start though, as I love the premise. I'm a sucker for movies about time travel or similar ideas. This is one that's interesting since we are getting a time loop. What I like is that we don't necessarily know how long or how far this is reaching, and the more we get into it, the farther it goes, and that is just amazing to me. There's just some good writing here, and that all takes all the way back to the beginning. There are subtle things that got revealed that made my jaw drop, and I wanted to give credit to all that. So where I'm going to go from there is that we get a sort of slasher film, not in the traditional sense though. Our villain is using a gun for the most part, so I know that makes it not necessarily fall into that subgenre. There is a time where I believe someone is stabbed, though. Regardless, when they get on this ocean liner, we have this masked figure. I love that they look like Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th Part 2 by wearing a sack on their head. Seeing what it is interesting. I love that look. Who is under it is even better. I also like the reason that they're attacking these survivors and what they believe will happen if they do. Now, I'm going to shift this over again to the time loop. We don't know how long it goes and where it loops. We think we do, and then another wrinkle gets added. I see why there are comparisons to time crimes, as there are similar elements and plot points. The difference there is that the one goes more into science, where the movie leans into more here of what is actually happening, but we don't get answers why. Now, the scientific idea that time is a flat circle is here. We comprehend time in a linear fashion, as we cannot wrap our head around it. I love that we get to see a bit of that representation. Seeing how much this played out was crazy to see. The last bit that I'll add here is that I read that the answer to the question about why this is called Triangle, they're still using the idea of the Bermuda Triangle, and the mystery around that area amazes me. And it actually kind of seems like this ship was supposed to have started like in Miami, so it goes through that area. So I think that's what they're trying to say here. And then we also have this like freak electrical storm, which might have been them kind of crossing over into this time loop. Now, making it kind of like a wormhole of sorts. I don't know if there's anything more that I need to flesh out with the story, and I don't think I'm necessarily smart enough to. So go over to the acting. I think Melissa George is good as our lead. I like that we get to see a bit of her home life, and more gets revealed later. She shows a range of emotions and characters, and I enjoyed that. Then some of the other people that we have here are Michael Dorman, Henry Nixon, Rachel Capani, Emma Leung, and Liam Hemsworth. I thought they were all also good. I like that they don't seem to know what is going on as the main character of Jess tries to navigate. She tries to make them see, but it's difficult as it's so unbelievable. Then the last thing is going to be the filmmaking. I think this is shot well. The cinematography is good. I like seeing something from one direction and then getting to see it from other angles. As Jess navigates through this ship and, you know, time loop. Then with the effects, I thought those were also good. We don't get a lot, but we also don't necessarily need them. The blood looks real enough, which is all I ask for. There is CGI, and it doesn't look great, but I also, that necessarily isn't a focal point, so it doesn't ruin anything either. Other than that, there would be the soundtrack. I thought that fit for what was needed. Much like with the different angles, we hear things and getting to see them from other ways, and that is interesting, and I think they do some good things with the sound there. So in conclusion, this is an interesting movie. I love the concept of time loops and mixing in elements of a slasher film while also getting it on a ship in the ocean. This makes it difficult to get away. We also have characters that don't necessarily know what is going on. George has a good performance as our lead. She shows some interesting range of emotions and characters. This is well made. It is taking some lofty ideas. I would recommend this movie as I rather enjoyed this one quite a bit. So my rating here for Triangle is going to be a 4 out of 5 on the T-Put scale. So, Duncan, can't wait to hear the episode, as well as, I believe, your thoughts and everybody else's who, you know, gave this a watch and sends in their review. This is David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
And thanks very much to David for submitting in his review. And there you go. That's the show. So all that's left for me to do is give you some details on how you can take part in episode number 3 with your reviews of Primer and then gear up the next movie we are discussing. It's already been mentioned. I'm very excited to do it for sure. But we will be taking a jaunt into more recent time and a movie that owes a little bit to the giallo. That's right. Duncan said it. Oh, doesn't it feel great to put that out there? And when I say it owes a lot to it, I mean, there are some elements that are indicative of, but it's not a giallo by any stretch of the imagination. It is Last Night in Soho by Edgar Wright. That is our final movie that we'll be doing in this initial first three-part run in the old time travel horror segment before we then swing to another aspect of science fiction horror. So that's the next movie. However, you can get in touch with me with reviews of Primer. I want them no later than the Monday the 17th of April. The episode will drop Sunday the 23rd. So that's Monday the 17th of April for your review of Primer. Get them in. The episode will drop on Sunday the 23rd of April. And that is us done, ladies and gents. Thank you very much for checking another episode of Where to Begin With. I look forward to catching all of you and your reviews in 1 month's time. But until then, wherever you are, please take care of yourselves, and I will speak to you next time.